I've no excuse to be this tired at 9:30 at night.
All right, let me break out the glass pot.
Well, yeah, what am I, 60 years old?
First you want to kill me, now you want to kiss me. Blow.
Hey, you've got 3 seconds for it.
I'm going to amp this baby up, see how it sounds.
This is the FakeShamp.net podcast. My name's Glenn.
I'm Jared.
I'm Sean.
And thank you for listening. It's great to have your company. We've got a bit of a different episode for you this week. We've got the 30th anniversary of Frog Dreaming. Can you believe it's been 30 years?
Outstanding.
I have nothing to say about that because I've never seen the film until tonight.
How old are you, Sean, if you don't mind answering the good people?
21.
Okay, that's a good
one. I've been 21 for about 12 years
this
now.
This movie's older than you, so
yeah,
that's understandable.
Yeah.
No, 33.
33, right. Yeah, because I was trying to work out with this particular film, you know, obviously I saw it the first time on video, so it would have been maybe 6 or 7 at the time. I mean, I imagine you would have been around the same age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we kind of have grown up with this film, whereas a good friend here, Sean, was introduced to it tonight. But you did have some vague recollection that you may have seen it before.
It's a weird thing because I grew up down the peninsula, down the Mornington Peninsula, where some of the film was shot, the big quarry. And I visited the quarry with my first long-term girlfriend. Ah, oh, good days. No.
How old were you at that time?
17.
Right.
Went to the quarry with her, came back alone.
Yes.
Yeah, by myself. There's been a horrible accident. No. She and her brother, who were massive fans of it, they took me down, and that's when I first learned about it. Her brother Dave, he was like, oh, this is where they shot this movie, Frog Dreaming. I was like, I actually have no idea what you're talking about.
Well, now you do.
Because that's the other interesting thing, obviously, because, you know, we grew up with it living here in Australia.
Yeah.
This film is an internationally, you know, it's known overseas under various titles, but, you know, people on message boards are always talking about it.
Look, let's get into that in a minute, but first, should we have a listen to the trailer?
Yeah, it sounds good.
3, 2, 1, go!
You loved him in E.T. Now Henry Thomas is back as Cody Walpole. Cody is an adventurer about to discover the secret of frog dreaming.
Gazza, what do you know about a pond 5 miles east of Devil's Knob?
Well, I want you to promise me you'll stay away from that pond.
Do you believe in monsters?
Some for 20 years. I was married to one.
First you dance with the devil. Then you find out about Dunkerton.
Cody, just hang on. This is going too far. That thing could be 1,000 feet deep, if there's a bottom at all.
I reckon I got about 3 minutes worth of air down there. Ooh! Ooh!
Henry Thomas from E.T. is Cody Walpole, whose search for adventure takes you to the depths of a legend. The legend of Frog Dreaming.
And there we have it. This movie, to me, is a massive nostalgic trip. You know, it is my favourite Australian film for the nostalgic factor. This is me thinking back to childhood at the video store on a Saturday morning with my friends in the lounge room before we go out and play, watching Frog Dreaming. You know, this and BMX Bandits were the two seminal films of our childhood. And when I watch this now, like, I'm taken back. Like, you know, I feel like a kid again. We used to go on adventures in our neighborhood like this. We had creeks and hills stuff like that. And this film is exactly the stuff we used to do, probably on a more extreme level. But, yeah, to me, this is just fantastic entertainment. Came right off the hot heels of The Goonies and E.T. and had that sense of adventure that international films had. And, you know, this was our own.
Yeah.
That's so representative of our childhood, too. I was going to say, because, you know, all our kids, our generation, we used to get the BMX bikes out and go on adventures.
Oh, yeah.
This film brings back all the memories of going to school camp when I was in primary school, and this would be one of those films they'd show at camp when, you know, they'd gather around for dinner, not, you know, we weren't roughing it when you're in grade 5 or whatnot.
Yeah, dorms.
And they'd play the film. And watching it tonight, obviously, there's some there's certain things in it that obviously you wouldn't be able to put in a film now just because of the way
PC.
Yeah. And just thinking, yeah, you know, we watched that, you know, a whole bunch of us, we were like 9 or 10 watching it. But I remember watching this with those kids and thinking, watching them being so terrified and thinking, this is the closest they've seen to a horror film.
Yes.
Jeez, they haven't seen shit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Everett DeRoche, the writer, the legendary
yeah.
Everett DeRoche wrote this, and we'll talk about him in a bit, but he describes this as a kiddie chiller. He
totally.
Wrote this as a
yeah.
kiddie horror film. And I watched it with my kids about 3 or 4 years ago when they were a lot younger and impressionable. Scared the living daylights out of them.
Yeah.
It worked the treat all these years later.
I can imagine it would. Even being removed from the childhood aspect and watching it now as an adult, it falls so closely in line with all the films that I have those feelings about, you know, like E.T. and like The Goonies and all that kind of stuff. It just, it's so closely aligned with everything that I can, and that it's hard not to be kind of swept up in the nostalgia, even though I have no nostalgia for the film.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like it has that kind of sparkling.
It's familiar.
Yeah, it has that sparkling John Williams-esque score.
Doesn't
and,
it? Yeah,
yeah.
The Brian May score is very reminiscent of John Williams.
It is.
Like it doesn't feel that far removed from E.T. at the start.
Okay, well let's just have a moment of silence because we'll lift that score up right now.
That's
beautiful.
It is something else, isn't it? But even like even the kids, you know, riding through the bush and the bikes and, you know, the little bits and pieces, you know, like I don't want to ruin anything for the people out there who perhaps haven't seen the film. If you haven't seen the film, P.S.
You've got to
turn
this podcast
turn this
off,
podcast off and go watch it.
Come,
yeah.
come back
yeah.
after.
But it does. It's full of this sense of wonder and excitement. And like you say, it is actually, even looking at it now, it does have some chilling moments. Like, there's a sort of sense
children
of,
in peril.
Yeah, tangible sense of dread. It's really impressive. It's really good.
And the funny thing, when I was a kid, like, I didn't distinguish between American films and Australian films. It was either it was a good film or it wasn't a good film. It didn't matter where it was from. But in this one, you had that American kid in the lead role, and there was something really weird. As a kid, you felt like, how awesome is this? Like, that big Hollywood star is in our movie.
And
in our
fans too, because this is the funny thing too. E.T. obviously was released in 82. This was 86.
Yeah.
And then E.T. never came out on home video in Australia until 87. So to us, like, E.T. was released every year pretty much theatrically. They would reissue E.T. back into cinemas and that. So we were like, oh, wow. You know, you couldn't even watch E.T. at home. And it's like the journey had continued.
Yeah.
And I think it was even on the video cover. It had a little tagline, you know, what was it? Henry Thomas of E.T.'s next adventure.
And interestingly, this film, Frog Dreaming, opens up with a sequence on bicycles that's very reminiscent of E.T. You know when E.T., when they're...
the finale of E.T.
When in E.T., they're dropping down on the home estate, sort of, you know, with the bikes going over the edge of these massive mounds. They do that in Frog Dreaming.
Yeah,
it's amazing, the similarities. And that is some stunning cinematography. The shots, the way they're set up with cars and bikes going at the same time.
Overhead,
really,
like camera laid on, obviously, you know, in the ground.
Yeah,
you know,
Glenn and I
crunch.
Just touched on it earlier. I was surprised. I don't know what I was expecting. There was a part of me that kind of felt like I was expecting a sort of Crawford's production, that kind of idea, like a
like
very
Henderson Kids.
Yeah, like a Henderson Kid, like a dated Australiana, slice of Australiana. When in reality, I was really impressed by the cinematic qualities, particularly of the first act.
Yeah,
like it was really, really well executed, really well calibrated, really well thought out. It's obvious Trenchard Smith, I mean, like, the guy's, you know, like a genius, but like, it's obvious he's got passion for this, and it shows, like, it rattles along. The design of the shots at the beginning are
absolutely
really sweeping.
The editing
really,
itself too, that tight editing between, and
really,
did it pick up an AFI for best editing?
No, it was nominated, but
not
the one that it won best. Oh no, it did win best editing.
Yeah,
of course, I apologise
to
Brian Kavanagh, who probably will listen to this. He picked up the AFI for it.
Because
it
really
surprising.
And that,
put together that opening sequence, just the cuts.
Yeah, and that
was
the only
montage.
Award it won. It got nominated for a heap that year.
That's a
tragedy.
It's a
shame.
Oh, it's a massive shame. I can't recall what it was up against.
I was going to say,
Crocodile Dundee came out that year, so that's hit 30 years this year as well. So that probably swept it, you know.
Yeah.
Location-wise, it was shot in several parts of Victoria, mostly up at Woodend, which is up in sort of the alpine country of Victoria, which you can still go up to. You might recall at the start of the film, there was like a little service station.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's still there. You can go up there.
Cool.
Unless that burnt down in the fire. But I have a funny feeling that remains.
Right.
A lot of it was shot down. The quarry itself, with the Muradot Quarry in Mount Martha. You can still go there now and
Yeah,
and
visit. I've been, yeah.
And in fact, if you go to Facebook, there's a Frog Dreaming fan page, and there's photos of people, myself included, visiting there years later, and it's an amazing place to go with the knowledge of Frog Dreaming.
Yeah.
Like, it's a really haunting kind of atmosphere to be in.
And that's, I was going to mention, the weird thing is, I remember when I moved to Melbourne, because as a kid, I grew up with this movie. I lived in Brisbane growing up.
Yeah.
And so when I moved to Melbourne, I think I was looking in the message boards for this film just randomly, and I realized it was shot here. I was kind of like, I've got to see these locations. So now I definitely have to see. But it just feels like, it kind of feels weird moving from Queensland to Melbourne and feeling like what had been, for me, pretty much a very Hollywood-type movie.
Mm.
Mm.
It's fucking shot here in Australia, shot here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
That's very special.
That's probably a good way of putting it. It does feel very Hollywood.
And
it?
Ironically, when Brian's back in Australia making movies, he makes them in Queensland. So.
Yeah,
there
you go.
I
grew in the wrong
He's
decade.
Avoiding
yeah.
you, Jarrett.
Yeah, I said Joey Peterson instead.
let's touch on, before we get on to Everett, because I want to talk about him for a little bit.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of the titles. I mean, obviously in Australia, it's called Frog Dreaming. In the UK, it's known as The Go Kids, with a cover art that's very reminiscent of The Goonies.
Yeah, absolutely.
In America, it's The Quest, with some fairly average poster art. There's a few versions. And then in the UK, in other parts of Europe, it's called Spirit Chaser. So it's got all these
titles. It seems like a real waste of time to change it out. Because Frog Dreaming is such an integral part of the story. I don't understand why...
Well, that does not translate outside of Australia.
It barely translates inside of Australia.
Well,
still
but
exactly.
We know...
The context of the film, I wouldn't... You know, I guess the word dreaming...
Yeah.
It's
got indigenous context
that
they wouldn't understand outside. And actually, you know, we should let the listeners know that we did an interview with Brian Trenchard-Smith, which is coming up soon. I asked him about those titles, and he said irrefutably it would not have played well with Frog Dreaming outside of Australia.
Yeah, right.
He said these days, though, which I'll let him speak for himself, but these days it would play out there because we're a bit more savvy.
Of course.
You know, and international and all
right.
that. What's your preferred title? Frog Dreaming to me is that makes sense because
it's the way
we're
I mean, I don't know other than anything but.
I don't think the Go Kids works.
I don't think anything else works except for Frog Dreaming.
Spirit Chaser, perhaps.
Spirit Chaser, yeah, but. I mean, like, it's still a bit so big and it's kind of taken the long way around, isn't it? Like, it's...
Yeah.
That's just me.
All right, so let's get on to Everett, right? This is the only film that Everett de Roche has ever produced. He considered it his most personal film, and he's written some of the most seminal Australian films of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
Right,
yeah.
Stuff like...
One Weekend,
Road Games, there's so many.
Razorback, my all-time favourite Australian film,
there
Razorback.
You go.
Is it really? Is that your favourite?
Absolutely my favourite Aussie film.
Well, for people like us, it makes sense that our favourite Aussie films are related to Everett de Roche.
Yeah.
He's written the best genre
absolutely.
Films Australia's ever seen. Ironically, he's American. But he's got his finger on the Australian pulse, And yeah, so Frog Dreaming was his most personal, and he produced it and had a hell of a lot of hands-on with the production. And... Let's talk about Everett for a little bit. Like, what is your favourite Everett de Roche film? Obviously, this one's mine. Yours is...
Razorback.
What about yours?
I think it's probably Razorback.
Yeah?
And look, to be honest, I mean, like, I was late to the party when it comes to Everett de Roche. I think the first Everett de Roche film that I saw was Storm Warning, actually.
Oh, right.
Back in the day. Yeah. So I've got a soft spot for Storm Warning, but, you know, that's a...
Well, that's a script he wrote a long time ago.
And it's easy to see why. Imagine getting made in the 80s. Forget it. But no, look, outside of that, I would have to say Razorback.
Yeah.
I really
do. And he's done amazing things like Harlequin. That's a really overlooked film. Slapshot, which is getting released on Blu-ray through Glassdoor. That's amazing.
You see, he's got a very body of work. And granted, a lot of it does skew toward more the horror stuff. But
then he did Wind Rider.
Absolutely. Was that in the... Cole Kidman?
Which came
three years. Who was the male lead in that one?
That was Tom Burlingame.
It was Tom.
Yeah.
It was the man from Snowy River. Yeah.
BMX Bandits, of course.
Ah,
yeah.
Yes.
No,
he didn't.
I'm thinking Brian.
Yeah.
I might be able to edit that bit out. Make myself look like a dickhead then.
Definitely edit that out.
But Link with Richard Franklin,
which I'm still hanging for to get a release.
Is Link? Link is the
monkey,
woman of monkey.
Monkey
boy.
Yes.
Was that Everett de Roche?
Yes.
Can
and
you believe
and
I
Richard Franklin.
That. Richard Franklin.
Jeez, I mean, there's so many. He did a lot of TV. Oh, he did. Is it Yankee Zephyr?
Oh yeah, the hunt, the race for
the Yankee Zephyr.
Yeah, he was incredibly prolific, wasn't
yes,
he? Like,
absolutely.
He could, like, guy just like smashed out scripts before breakfast and then went about his day.
Yeah, and it, and I said it a moment ago, it took an American to come in and see Australia sort of from a bigger perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
And he sort of had his sort of stamp on the Australian landscape and the culture probably more than anyone else at the time. It's amazing. Oh, let's not forget bloody Fortress.
Oh, yes, of course, because that was one year.
Speaking of
profit
production,
that would have been 85.
Yeah.
That's one he never really put his hand up and said, yeah, that's my film, because that was based on a novel. It's an adaptation,
an
original story of his. But, you know, I credit him for that one. That's a freaking amazing film.
People probably be really surprised, actually, to know just how much of an impact he had on the Australian cinema landscape. Because, I mean, even at film school, his name was never dropped.
Yeah.
Not once.
Tragedy.
It's crazy.
Yeah, tragedy.
Given how much he's done and how much he, how involved he was, it seems crazy that nobody really. He's not a more well-known household name.
It's fantastic though. In his later years before he passed away, he managed to pump out a couple of decent films.
Yeah.
You know, Visitors. That was another Richard Franklin
one.
That's
right. Yeah,
And The Long Weekend. Remake is, debate. People, that's a bit of a contentious issue, but also Storm Warning, and, he left on a really good note, I think.
Absolutely.
You know?
How old was he when he passed?
Oh, I wouldn't know his actual age.
I think he's in his mid-60s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was young.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right, let's move it along. How about some interviews?
Sound it.
I'm fanging for it.
So we roped in Rachel Friend. Everyone remembers Rachel Friend.
Yes.
Rachel Friend was in Neighbours, of course, and in Frog Dreamy she played Wendy. And I had the biggest crush on her when I was a kid.
I did too.
I can't lie.
I did too.
All right, so I was a bit chuffed when she agreed to come along and participate in the FakeChamp.net podcast, and for her to say Glenn and FakeChamp.net, I sort of lost myself a little bit there.
I cried a little bit in St. Jared, actually.
You're actually blushing.
Okay. Take it away, Rachel.
Hello, my name is Rachel Friend, and I played Wendy Cannon in Frog Dreaming. 30 years, I cannot believe it's 30 years, and yet in so many ways, I guess, when I reflect on the movie and making the movie, it actually sort of almost feels like it happened to someone else, someone I knew, maybe a friend or something. As far as getting involved, it's a funny story. I almost didn't get involved. I had a younger sister, I have a younger sister, her name's Annabelle. She's 2.5 years younger than me. And it was Annabelle that was actually asked to go on audition for the movie. I was considered too old at the time. I was 14. And I think they were looking for kind of 13 and under. Anyway, I ended up going along to the audition simply because I think Mum didn't know what else to do with me. And they had a height chart. You had to get through that first. And I was really probably a little bit too tall. But I managed to kind of roll over on my heels and make myself as short as I possibly could, and got through that part of the audition, and then went in to read a script and appeared to do pretty well and got called back. And then with the second read through, I read alongside someone who's very well known now. Asha Keddie was trying out for the role of the younger sister Jane, and as it turned out, Tamsin got the role. As far as working with Henry Thomas, he was a huge name star at that time. We all knew him from E.T., so it was incredibly exciting to have Henry come and make the movie. He was really quiet and humble and very professional, kind of kept to himself. He always sort of seemed older than his years, which I guess is probably a product of working in the industry from a really young age. But there were, in total, there were actually 6 kids on set all the time. We all had a stand-in, so we had someone who looked just like us, who would then stand in when they were doing the setups, the shot setups, so that they could get around the sort of restricted working hours for kids. So we were all pretty close and got on really well as a group of kids. And we had a reasonable time off school, maybe, I don't know, 6 or 10 weeks or something. And so we had tutors that would teach us, go through our school lessons on set. We lived in a motel in Frankston for a reasonably big part of the shoot, maybe a month, which was all pretty exciting. And we had a chaperone, an older lady by the name of Thea, that would look after us kids. Funny, working with Brian Trenchard-Smith, if my memory serves me correctly, Brian was not the original director. We had somebody else, and I don't recall his name now, but there was a different director that started on the shoot, and I think that there may have been maybe a couple of weeks break where obviously something had gone wrong, and they looked for a new director, and Brian Trenchard-Smith came along, and he ended up, you know, picking up the pieces and making the rest of the movie, thank goodness. As far as interesting stories, I mean, it's so long ago. It was such an incredible time. I remember just loving every minute of it. We had a lot of fun. We got to, you know, live away from home. At one point, I remember we had to do some filming in a little town called Woodend. We stayed in the local pub. That's where I actually fall off the motorbike. And my beautiful Nana came with me as my chaperone during that part of the filming, which was a really special time. She'd just sit and watch, you know, the goings-on each day, and then we'd, you know, have dinner each night together. So that was really special. And, yeah, and then the film came out. I think we went to a premiere. That was exciting. And then I recall getting the bus into the city in Melbourne with my sister, and the two of us went just on a normal regular session to watch the movie. And I think I was probably kind of disappointed that no one really recognised me and put two and two together that I was actually sitting in the theatre watching myself. But that's kind of my thoughts. It's amazing to think it's 30 years since we made this movie. I am really surprised that there are people out there that loved it and still really, really like it. I do think it's a really unusual movie. I think it took me a while to really understand what Donkey Engine was and what this thing was, you know, this beast, this monster that was in the bottom of the pond. And, you know, it was all, you know, a really complex kind of story. But I'm really proud to have been a part of it. And I thank everyone for their interest in the project, and thanks Glenn from fakeshemp.net for putting this together. Bye.
So there we go, Rachel Friend.
Lovely lady.
I'm still fanboying over that.
What an insight. Thanks for your time, Rachel. That was
awesome. That was lovely. Thank you.
Good to finally hear from Rachel
this
too
is
on the
thing.
Film.
The film's been covered, you know, previously, you know, in other media.
Mm.
But you don't hear from Rachel all that often.
Yeah,
on it.
The lead actress
in it. That's right. And, you know, for her to you know, give us that information and share her stories and be really personal about it, fantastic.
Yeah, thank you.
And now for the piece de resistance. Is that how you say it?
Yep, we'll run with it.
All
sure,
right.
Why not?
You're the guy that works in a cafe.
Yeah, piece de resistance.
Okay, so we scored an interview with Brian Trenchard-Smith, and he gave us a hell of a lot of information. Really awesome conversation. It does go for 25 minutes, so brace yourself in, get yourself a coffee, and tune into this, because it is fucking amazing.
Take it away, Glenn.
Hi, Glenn.
Hi, Brian. How are you going?
I'm going just fine.
So, I'd like to start off by saying, 30 years, the film has held up incredibly well. It's definitely my favourite Australian film. What do you think has kept it so enduring after all these years?
Well, I think it's a universal coming-of-age story. Everyone identifies with, you know, that moment in childhood when you become an adult, or the beginnings of an adult. It evokes a kind of comfortable, old-fashioned country lifestyle of the 50s and into the 60s, I suppose, in Australia. It celebrates Aboriginal mythology in a respectful way. So it has a number of ingredients, I think, that don't generally all occur in a kid's picture, and I think there are things that parents and children can talk about after seeing it. So Yeah, I hoped it would be a perennial, and I'm glad it is.
So I know you have discussed before on Mark Hartley's documentary, you briefly discussed how you got involved with Frog Dreaming. Just to put some context into this discussion, can you just briefly talk about how you became involved with the film?
Well, I had just finished shooting an episode of 5 Mile Creek for Henry Crawford's company, and the day that the shooting was ending, I got a call, and I said yes, and wouldn't tell me what it was. And then said the producer and the two producers will meet with you this evening at the end of the shoot, Cole Kidman and Kevin Dobson, who would be directing her in upcoming episodes, including the next one. And this was kind of like a director-to-director handover dinner where I naturally sang Nicole's praises to this guy. So that was the purpose of that dinner, and that was fun. And then halfway through, Everett DeRoche and Barbie Taylor came in to another table, and they were the people I was to meet. And then I left Kevin with Nicole and went over and heard that they would like to make a change, and would I take over? And I said, yeah, of course, because I'm a great admirer and I've made trailers for, you know, scripts. Well, I've made trailers for movies that he wrote. And at one point, you know, nearly took over another film that he wrote, Race for the Yankee Zephyr. But that's another story.
That is. Well, interestingly, Nicole Kidman went on to work with Everett on Wind Rider 3 years later.
Yes, I think, I mean, Nicole, you could tell, was going to be a star. And, you know, just wherever she went, whatever she did, she was luminous. The camera loved her, and she was, you know, skillful in interpreting the text, or as actors have to do, you know, faking reality. And she just had she was a natural. And look, she has had the career that I predicted. And it's not over yet.
No, not by a long stretch.
So that's how I first became introduced into the project. So the next day I looked at the footage that was shot and went on and met with Henry and listened to his concerns, showed him BMX Bandits, and in which we got a, you know, you can't do that these days so easily, but we just rang up the local, you know, Village Roadshow Theatre and said, hey, can we, you know, run this first thing in the morning before your session starts? And they said, oh, sure. So Henry got to see BMX Bandits on the widescreen. Then that was the weekend, that was the Saturday, and started shooting the next day, on the Monday, I think it was. I don't know, it was a long time ago, but it was then 36 Fast and Furious days that I loved every minute of. And it was great working with everybody, and there was great sort of esprit de corps. And Barbie Taylor and Everett were, you know, they really wanted to make the best film they possibly could. And they, you know, they were very smart about it. They had chosen great locations. Everett was very involved in the production process. And because so often a writer does not have his script protected creatively after it's been handed over to a producer and a director. But, you know, this was a good team where Barbie wanted Everett's vision on the screen. And so did I. And so I applied myself to that vision, which I was in sync with this kind of 50s ambiance of the country town. So that was great. And the script offered me opportunities to do sequences I enjoy, such as all the BMX stuff, and the spooky meeting with Charlie Pride, and a number of other little set pieces. It was a great experience.
Well, fantastic. You've actually answered a couple of my questions in that, which is fantastic. So I would like to just quickly discuss Everett. By his own admission, you know, this is his most personal film and the only one he ever took a producer's credit on. And I was going to ask you what it was like to work with him, but you answered that. And I was just wondering, it's interesting that the two of you were possibly the most prolific voices in Australian cinema at that time. Did you ever have an opportunity to work later on down the road that just never came to fruition?
Yes, sadly. A sequel to Conan. Boy, we could have made a great movie out of that. No. But Dino De Laurentiis was thinking of doing something in Australia, and I had proposed, being a Conan fan, that you'd think about doing a Conan film in a tropical and beach and reef setting. And I got a certain amount of lip service to that, and in the end, my deal with Dino didn't work out. And Everett had this other idea that had been germinating for a while about, an ecological disaster, whatever, has caused the oceans to rise, and therefore the skyscrapers at Surface Paradise are, half of them are jutting out of the water. And there are these separate skyscraper communities that over the eons have become inhabited totally by women as a refuge. And the population grows through, genetic programming of all babies to be female. So it's a total woman society, which has to defend itself against male pirates. Well, into this idea of Everett's, we put Conan, who gets washed up against the skyscraper and taken in by this all-female society, and you can imagine there would be some interesting opportunities for drama and comedy in that scenario. So that was the basic outline of it, and I pitched it, but it fell on stony ground. But it would make a wild movie, and still would.
I'm outraged that it didn't get made. I'd love to see that.
Oh, yes. Well, it could have some interesting points to make about tribalism and let's say science out of control.
Absolutely. Well, Everett wrote some very edgy stuff for Frog Dream, especially for a family movie. And you had swearing, you had smoking. There was an element of horror in there. He described it as a kiddie thriller. Were there ever any concerns of how dark it was going? Was there any pressure to tone it down?
No. I've never met a moment of controversy that I didn't like. So I thought, great. Goodness me, today they'd be smoking weed and doing lines or something. But that's a different kind of Hollywood movie. But did you have to see, what was that, film 14? A fairly shocking depiction of the teen life in Los Angeles. Anyway, back to Frog Dreaming, and a nicer, gentler period, socially speaking. But smoking the conflict between the sisters, and I like that. And Henry wanted to stretch a bit more with the film, and he wanted a scene where he emotionally let rip. So Everett provided it. The one with Tony Barry when he does lose it emotionally, and but that was a great moment for Henry. Everett had a good insight into character and into how the way children feel, because he is the father of six children and goodness knows how many grandchildren by now. But he certainly had quite a few grandchildren before he passed on. So he was a great observer of parental-child relationships, and I think he brought his insight to Frog Dreaming and to all the kids' series stuff that he did in the 90s.
Do you think the same film could be made in today's age, like in the context of being a family adventure?
Well, yes, I know, it would not be considered edgy today. I was encouraged to make BMX Bandits edgier in terms of making the cops more threatening and real. So there was certainly never any pressure to conform to standard sort of conservative children's film values, let's say.
I'm actually also interested to know, of the abandoned footage that was shot before you came along, has any of that survived? Do you think it would ever see the light of day?
I don't think it would, really, because we picked the eyes out of it. And the most sustained piece of it is in that the Rockabilly. That's really the most sustained piece from the original footage.
And the film, of course, around the world has several different titles. You've got The Quest in the USA, Go Kids in the UK, Spirit Chaser in some parts of Europe. Do you have a preferred title yourself?
I like the intriguing original title, Frog Dreaming. And I think as the world gets a little bit more hip, that will become, that's a title where people say, what? What is that about? They don't have a poster with a giant frog on the front with a man's hand hanging out of it, and then totally try and missell the movie. Mm-hmm. And that sort of thing has happened, actually. Not with Frog Dreaming, but with other movies. I think Frog Dreaming is an excellent title because there's sort of ecological subtext to the movie, and that helps point an audience that way. Any title that gets bums on seats, I always say.
Well, that's true. I agree with you with the original title. Do you think in retrospect that the original title would have fared well around the world at that time?
Undoubtedly not. But now I think the world is a little bit more ready for the Aboriginal mystical side of the movie and knows just a little bit more perhaps about the native Australians, the first Australians. I think an ad campaign could actually use that as a plus, and it may initially be, I think it's still pleasing to a kid audience today. They accept it's old-fashionedness, but they're hooked by Henry. Henry's got great magnetic charm, and I think it doesn't play as a slow movie necessarily anymore to kids that are into that sort of thing.
So I wanted to talk about some of the technical aspects of the film. I mean, you had stuff like, tricky stuff like the rail track bicycle and Donkey Gen itself. And given the breakneck pace of the production, what was the biggest challenge in pulling that all off?
Every kind of mechanical gag like that or stunt gag, it requires a lot of careful thought and preparation. And I will say this, that a great deal of thought had gone into it prior to my arrival. Which was good. The railway bike was a little bit of a worry because it could come apart quite easily. We had a couple of slightly, near spills. So I minimized the amount of time Henry actually spent on it. And we came up with a way of putting him on a low loader securing the bike to some, like a treadmill of drums, of perfectly smooth, round, drums that he pedaled and pushed hard, and looked like he was biking. The wheels were just sort of going around on the drums. So a low angle from just below the handlebars, which incorporated the front wheel turning, that gave the lie to the fact that he was actually speeding along. And the trees were, receding on either side of him. It really looked like he was certainly riding along the rails. So we cut that, did that on a long straight road and cut that into the shots of the double riding the actual railway bike, which we speeded up in a couple of areas. And as for the crash, we had to, I break things down into a series of shots as they would ultimately edit together. And then you've got the coverage that you need. As long as you've got it so that it will stitch together fluidly, then that's the important thing. So those little moments had to be, carefully sort of planned in advance. The mechanical Donkey Gen was quite a feat of engineering because you have to take into account water weight. And John Dowding, you know, did a fantastic job, and I've worked with John since. It was a really great effort, and we were able to put Henry in the water as it rose up, and get shots of the real guy with this monster in the same frame. Nowadays, maybe we'd do it with green screen or something, but in those days, seeing had to be believing. And we had a diver in the water, and his mother was there to watch. He did well, and he looked like he was really struggling. And that was great.
A little bit evil.
Yeah, well, it was a good image, and people, I think, are sufficiently, you know, carried along by the way that, you know, Everett has steered the mythology, and they accept both sides of Darker Jim, the mystical side and the mechanical side, and the side involving, you know, the physics and the interaction of air and water.
Well, speaking of the mythology of it, the end scene is a very strange, perplexing piece of, I suppose, surrealism, possibly metaphorical. Was that in the script or was that done on the fly? Was it an afterthought?
It was at the end, and then we came back with photo doubles and some of the original actors, and picked up new scenes that had been dropped, you know, from the schedule prior to my arrival. Henry had finished his contract, but we made sure we had all the shots we needed of him. And then, you know, the ending was, you know, something that had arisen during production, as I understand it, and it seemed to be that, you know, you've got to have some kind of nice, not a sting in the tail necessarily, but the audience would like to believe that there's a bit of magic in science.
Frog Dreaming and Dead End Driving were released in the same month, I believe. Was there any creative connections between those films?
I don't think that is so.
No?
I don't believe... I mean, if you're talking about Australia,
okay.
Frog Dreaming was a school holiday picture. Might have been August school holidays or something like that. Dead End Drive-In was thrown away by Greater Union film distributors just before Christmas. In Sydney, it opened in the third screen of a theatre that was still under construction.
Wow.
Anyway, so it was doomed. In Australia, it has, you know, done very well for me internationally, and it's been recognised for what it is. But Frog Dreaming was similarly, it needed a more aggressive campaign.
Were you involved in any of the marketing?
No, I wasn't, because I was away doing another film. Let's see, what was it? It was 1985. But I did make, I think I made a trailer. No, actually, I didn't. Because I was too busy on Dead End Driving. That was one that was made without me. So I did make a lot of the early Australian trailers.
Right.
And that's how I came across Everett's work. First of all, Snapshot and Long Weekend.
I know, interestingly, when you had your interview with Mark Hartley, with Quentin Tarantino beside you, he mentioned at the time that Frog Dreaming or The Quest was the only one of your films that he hasn't seen. Do you know if he's watched it since?
I'm quite sure he has seen it, because he has a 16mm print in his personal vault, and he put that on at the New Beverly Cinema on Beverly Boulevard in Los Angeles late last year sometime. So I think he has seen it, but he's never seen it on the big screen, and for various bureaucratic reasons, the inheritors of the film have been denied access to them. We're looking internationally to see if old Interpos or something like that could be found in a foreign lab. I mean, these things can happen. That's how Wake in Fright was rediscovered and remastered, because there was an aging negative or Interpos or Interneg in some New York laboratory, and from that they were able to rebuild the film. So I hope the Well, I hope that the bureaucracy, you know, sees sense and allows us access to the original negative materials.
I know that Umbrella is definitely working towards it, so with a bit of luck...
Yeah, I'm working with Umbrella.
Oh, fantastic. And I know that Everett's family has a mountain of behind-the-scenes footage that they want to donate for, you know, special additional content and whatnot. So it would be a fantastic release if it happened.
Yeah, no, I think so. It's a film that, you know, that really nearly stumbled and fell and yet got up and ran. And sometimes out of the worst of luck, the best of luck can come with a movie. Though, you know, speaking personally, it's happened the other way around too. But I just would like it to be seen. And it's a time capsule of Australian rural life in a way that's packaged for, you know, an international family audience and particularly an American family audience. Anyway, there you have it. So is there anything else?
Well, not in regards to Frog Dreaming. I think that pretty much covers it. I would like to direct our listeners to the current Umbrella release, because there's an interview with yourself and Henry as well as Everett that covers a lot of the production that, you know, is definitely worth tapping into and having to listen to. If I could just ask one question, if you don't mind, because this one really is a curiosity for me. I recently, as of last week, finally got to watch your Pimpin' Pee-wee film, which I thought was far better than people have let on. I thought it was actually quite racy. It was far more explicit than any of the previous films. I really hope that one does get a release at some point.
How did you get to see it?
Well, it finally found its way onto YouTube, so the entire film is currently up there. I don't know how long it will last before they pull it down. I guess somebody had recorded it off the brief VOD that was, you know, released, but it's there.
Well, I tell your friends, grab a bit of... It's my first foray, really, into sexploitation.
Well, I can tell you what, it was a lot better than I had been led to believe, and I actually really, really enjoyed it. And the comedy was really on point, which was surprising to me. And to be honest with you, I ripped it off YouTube and put it onto disc, so I've got a copy to keep.
Please, and tell all your friends to do that quickly before it's taken down. I have no financial interest in it.
Sure.
It's one of those curious things that was made to satisfy a contractual requirement.
Yes, of course.
So that the backer could maintain the rights to the original Porky franchise. But it all ended in tears and litigation and whatever. But so the film doesn't have the release it would otherwise have had. It was sort of being held as the first video, direct-to-video, after they had remade the feature as a, you know, $12 million film or something.
Sure.
And then they could do the college years as a derivative. Anyway, it all went wrong. But 15 days, you know, that was, you know, quite a challenge. But it was fun. But they're all fun. And if you ever come across the Chemistry series, which has been on, you know, Cinemax, which is fairly explicit. It's a sex comedy set in a legal office. But I got to flex my comedy muscles there too. I'm really a comedy director. I can't help making some things funny.
Well, you do a great job at that.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you, Glenn. Goodbye for now.
Boom. So there you go. That's the end of the interview.
He couldn't wait to get away from you there.
Oh, no. No, it was like, because we had so much interference with the connection, and when I edit together, it sounds nice, but it actually ended more like, well, thanks for your time, Brian, and, you know, it's great having you on. And he was like, and we finally got a bit of, you know, air, and he goes, thank you, Glenn.
Wow. He seems like a really nice guy.
He's amazing.
He's really forthright.
I love this man. Like, he embodies my childhood. You know, he's fucking, you know, the things I love about growing up is Brian Trenchard-Smith, BMX Bandits, you know, all this cool stuff.
Without sounding too lofty, Brian Trenchard-Smith is such a massive reason why I like the films I like. Like, he's everything guys like us love. Like, he's just got that attitude, that mentality of, by any means necessary, whatever it takes, just get it done.
He's like a guerrilla filmmaker.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And whenever you listen to him on commentaries or, you know, special features or whatnot, that's exactly how he approaches films, you know? And I was telling you guys off the air, my favourite story
on the commentary for Dead End Driving, which if anyone's never seen Dead End Driving, go and see it.
I haven't seen Dead End.
Amazing. It is the epitome of exploitation.
Where can you get it?
Anywhere.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's got a...
It's available through Madden, but I think it may actually be out of print on DVD.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And I think it's out of print on DVD in the US now, too, because it's through Anchor Bay there.
Well, by whatever means necessary.
Yeah. I see what you did there.
But what he was saying is he's talking about production value and how it's easy to achieve production value by just blowing shit up. Mm. You know, gasoline's cheap, he says. Blow something up, it looks good on screen, and there's value in that. And that's how he talks, you know?
Yeah.
I would just love to spend a day on set with him.
Imagine being his attachment on a film.
And as he was talking in that interview about, you know, putting Henry Thomas in a certain element of danger and peril to get the shot, you know, might have...
P.S. Yeah. Can I just say, Henry Thomas in this film is probably the coolest child actor performance I've ever seen. That kid is cool as ice.
A little bit precocious.
I remember somebody once saying that an action hero always has the confidence to do less. And that just embodies Henry Thomas.
He's nonchalant all the way through it.
Just like, yeah, nothing phases him. Nothing gets a rise out of him. He's intelligent, and he's smart, and he's daring, and he's brilliant. And he's like, yeah.
I love the line where, you know, Rachel Friend says, you know, let's go on a picnic. And he's like, oh, a hike.
He's so much more warm and weary.
That's right. But then he says, you know, like, there's a bloke I know. he's great in it.
He legitimately
is. Like, he... it's a shame that we don't see more of him.
Yeah.
Because I reckon he's a
dumb. He worked again with Brian on Happy Face Murders, which was a fantastic murder mystery film. Really, really cool. Matt had, I'm not even going to guess who else was in that because I've forgotten. Ham Bancroft, perhaps?
Maybe, I don't
but
know.
Yeah,
I reckon I can think of the poster, but I've never
Henry Thomas him. And the chick from CSI played two sort of investigators, and it's like a Jessica Fletcher kind of thing, but a bit more graphic. So anyway, it was uber exciting to have Brian talk to us.
Yeah, man. This is the second time you've done an interview with Brian. You did one for the website
in
2013 or something.
Unfortunately, the thing that cut out when I was recording the interview with him was Welcome Back to Fake Champ, because he was one of our very first interviews. It's a really good in-depth interview.
Yeah.
He discusses far more than what he has, you know, in this interview about all of his work going right back to Man from Hong Kong.
Yes.
Right.
How that, and he holds that one very
closely. Which, I don't want to spoil anything for... put out any rumours out there, but I believe it is getting a Blu-ray release later this year.
Is it really?
Locally, and it may have some other Brian Trenchard Smith films on there as well. Ooh. A second disc, maybe.
That's exciting.
So, I won't say any more about it.
And of course, Turkey Shoot.
So
many good films.
So many classics. Out of the Body, I might mention, from 1989. One of my personal favourite Brian Trenchard Smith films, which is still not on DVD.
What is your favourite Brian Trenchard Smith?
It's going to be Frog Dream.
It is from
Definitely, absolutely.
Mine too.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, it's my favourite Australian film. So,
yeah,
goes without saying.
Yeah, tell us.
Megiddo.
Oh, the Amiga Code 2.
The Amiga Code 2.
Is this called Casper? What's his name?
Casper Van Dien.
Michael York.
Michael York and Mike
Bean.
Michael Bean.
The one from Terminator?
It's insane. It's bonkers. It's just this
CGI
mashup of like, it's much better than the first one.
And obviously, it's a Christian film, right? It's one of those,
Doomsday
kind of things. Yeah. And Brian's done an interview. He's not Christian at all. It's like, it was just a fun movie to be involved with. Like,
it
doesn't
looks
care.
Like,
yeah.
It's just pandemonium.
Yeah.
It's bonkers. It's really, it's
and he's
fun.
Really, really proud of his Leprechaun films.
Of course,
did he do three and back in
three and four?
Three and four.
Three and four.
It was three and four.
Yeah.
Space.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The one in Vegas?
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. I don't remember.
Lucky
Charms
or whatever,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, God.
Oh, Leprechaun. I'm just thinking, like, the Leprechaun films came out just as I was starting to get really into film when I was a kid.
Right.
So Leprechaun's got really
And whenever special. You whenever you hear any kind of interview with Brian, he always somewhere along the line manages to fit in, and don't forget to watch Leprechaun.
Really?
That's
awesome.
Yeah. If you want something really fun, watch Leprechaun.
Oh, really?
Watch my Leprechaun.
Just don't watch the remake.
Oh, that's another podcast. That is another podcast because we're going to clash like Titan.
You and me?
Yes.
Did you like it?
I loved it.
Oh, really?
No, I didn't love it, but I liked it.
Is this Origins?
Origins.
Because it's not a Leprechaun film.
It's not.
There is no Leprechaun in it.
No, what was it?
A tiny wrestler.
No, he's not in it!
It feels like it was just kind of reappropriated from another
Yeah, they just tagged the title on.
I mean, it's got a. We're talking about a film that's not related to Frog Dreaming. Let's move on.
Move on. We digress.
Well, that pretty much ties things up and brings us to the end.
That was a really exciting episode.
Fantastic film. And we do have a giveaway. We've got to give away a copy of Frog Dreaming from Umbrella Entertainment.
You're going to give it to me?
No.
Okay.
All you've got to do to win it, and you can't be a member of FakeChamp.net to win it. We know your email address, Sean.
Damn it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So all you've got to do is email contact@FakeChamp.net. Tell us which horror film Brian Trenchard-Smith references when discussing the title and poster art for Frog Dreaming.
I know what it is.
Good. You don't win.
Damn it.
Don't tell your loved ones either.
No. I'm really tough to tell everybody. Yes. And you don't know all my loved ones.
I'm going
to
stalk your friends list.
Somebody I know will get this DVD.
So there you go. You can win a copy for yourself. It's a fantastic release. It's got three interviews. Brian, Everett, and Henry Thomas. So that brings it to the end. We've got another episode coming up very soon where we will get back into the rhythm of everything else that's been happening in and around film.
This was a nice little digression.
Absolutely.
And it's the 30th anniversary. Who can believe it's 30 years old?
I can.
You can?
Yeah, well, I don't like us uttering 30 years constantly. It just reminds me how old I am now. I'm like,
for a guy that's, 43, you look really good.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, well,
thank
that's you. A really anticlimactic one. Right, everyone go out, see Frog Dreaming. It's out there, it's available, it's very cheap. You can buy it in the retailers, and you should have all. It's multi-zone too, you can watch it wherever you are in the world. So.
But be mindful that it is PAL, so if you are watching it in the US.
It is PAL and it is 4x3.
It is.
Well, there's no option there because
this is the broadcast master, which was what they could source for this particular release until they can get a hold of 35mm prints. And
We know who has a 35mm print.
We do.
It was screened at the Beverly.
That son of a bitch won't give it up.
Quentin?
Please.
He doesn't loan anyone 35mm prints. Brian, I don't know how he feels, because I lend someone a DVD and they get a scratch on it. 35mm print. I'd be Mad Max Roadwood.
Yeah. All right,
someone's gonna die.
Thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you on the next episode.
Ciao.
Bye.
Ha 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 ha